The investigation continues into who's shooting at vehicles along Valley freeways. How are we holding up?
More exposure and more hype and more drama can cause traumatic reactions in people that could lead to severe traumatic stress kind of symptoms in some people.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, navigating the choices for end-of-life care, how the Arizona Cardinals have raised the bar on themselves,
and how far back does that caffeine fix go?
Things are not all that different than they were. People liked stimulating drinks of this kind and were willing to go far and make connections in order to get them.
Plus, cheech on art and drones over your favorite store.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. As DPS and other agencies continue to investigate, they are asking the public for help. But what's the balance between residents helping and freaking out? For answers, we turn to Tess Neal, an assistant professor of psychology in the School of Social and Behavioral Sciences at ASU.
People certainly will react to events like this if they're stressed out by them. They might be paying more attention, especially if there's a perceived threat involved. And yes, they may alter their routine. They may also start experiencing symptoms of kind of like traumatic stress or wanting to avoid situations, wanting to avoid being on the freeway, especially where they know there may have been events involved. Or they may be paying attention to, for instance, timing of when these incidents might have occurred and avoiding being out at those times. People who are becoming very avoidant might avoid those freeways completely, and they might also exhibit some other kind of traumatic stress, kind of avoidance and numbing kind of symptom.
Is this a matter of being exposed to media coverage, being exposed to law enforcement announcements, or just the fact that it's happening can cause that?
All of the above, and especially the more coverage there is, the more people will be paying attention to it, and the more exposure people have to it, the higher the chance of reacting with traumatic kind of stress symptoms. So there were some pretty interesting studies that they did after 9/11, for instance, and the amount of time that a person was exposing themselves to media coverage, the amount that they were watching of these events where there was possible near-death experiences and threats and so forth, the amount of exposure was highly correlated with the amount of stress that people were exhibiting, even to the point that people were looking like they had PTSD symptoms just based on a high amount of media exposure.
So in a situation like this, how do people balance making sure that they know what's going on, if there need to be safety precautions taken, but not consuming so much information that they get really stressed out about it and feel the need to make drastic changes?
The best advice that has come out of the research is to be aware of what's going on, but not follow it closely. So be aware enough that you can protect yourself and protect your family, but don't be following necessarily, you know, all the details of every investigation and really trying to figure out who this might be and profiling and so forth. That level of attention and detail and focus could be more harmful than helpful.
Is there a balance that law enforcement needs to take in these situations between asking the public for help and, in this instance, having freeway signs with a phone number if you have tips on the shootings versus not really stressing people out, not scaring people?
I would not presume to tell law enforcement how to do their job. I would say it might be worth them thinking about and just being aware that more exposure and more hype and more drama can cause traumatic reactions in people that could lead to severe traumatic stress kind of symptoms in some people. But at the same time, law enforcement needs to be able to shut down a situation. And if there really is something going on here, the best source of information is going to be the public. So there certainly is a need for this kind of thing. But the labeling that the media and the law enforcement is using could be part of this. So for instance, now I know they're talking about the I-10 shooter, which is a very different kind of thing than just a generic report suspicious activity kind of announcement.
The longer that something like this goes on and the longer that there are incidents and the cases are not solved, does that increase the likelihood of somebody being more stressed about and maybe even showing signs of something like PTSD?
Yes, if there continue to be events. So if there are no more shootings, but law enforcement isn't finding whoever was involved, chances are that media exposure and police exposure, you know, asking for help, that that's going to taper off. It's going to go out of the public attention, and most people are going to stop, you know, being aware of it, and it's not going to affect them in the same way. But the longer it's in the public eye and the longer the real threat is present without it being solved, yes, certainly, again, it's that exposure. Exposure to the potential threat, and especially following it closely, is linked with symptoms of traumatic stress.
Tess Neal is an assistant professor of psychology in the School of Social and Behavioral Sciences at ASU.
In the interest of preserving its integrity, the Arizona Department of Public Safety has refused to discuss details of the investigation into the I-10 shootings. But KJZZ's Phil Latzman has been talking with some experts looking to gain insights on the investigation.
Law enforcement officials have been tight-lipped, to say the least, and understandably so. But Michael Haig is a forensic ballistics expert who specializes in the science of gunshots. He and his father, Lucian, have co-authored the textbook Shooting Incident Reconstruction. And, Mike, what kind of things is DPS looking for while they're conducting this investigation?
The first part of it is going to be scene work, examining the trajectories on the objects that are struck. So that's a key point because, of course, that's going to link back or give investigators an idea of where the shots came from, which can then allude to or help lead into who was there and who did it. And then the second part of it is the actual examination of the projectile items themselves in a laboratory environment. So first scene and then laboratory. And a lot of times, if it's done well, there's a lot of crossover between those two areas.
What are the biggest challenges facing law enforcement as they look into where these shots are coming from, who they're coming from? What are they dealing with?
Well, that's a tough question for me because I focus on the physical evidence. So the who never really even factors into my decision-making process. That's going to be more a law enforcement category because my background is not law enforcement as far as being an officer. My background is the science side of it. So the who can't help you there, unfortunately, and people that do my kind of job wouldn't be able to either. But we provide the information that the physical evidence tells us to those people who may then go and say, make an arrest or be able to link up a type of gun with an individual, something along those lines.
You and your father have authored a book called Shooting Incident Reconstruction, and you actually have gone as far as to reconstruct the Kennedy assassination. And that's obviously also a moving car, but can we learn anything from reconstructing events like that when we're dealing with events like this?
I think there are probably some parallels to be made there, but I think in general, the idea that shooting incident reconstruction is a very specific area of forensic and crime scene investigation that needs to be handled logically and with the idea that we go where the physical evidence leads us, not where we want to go, is a factor to all of these things, whether it's the John F. Kennedy assassination or whether it's the freeway shootings. Science guides us, and we simply look at the physical evidence and see what it is indicating to us.
So if you were actively involved in trying to solve this case, what would you be doing? What would the first thing that you'd be looking for?
It would most likely begin with examination of the vehicles that are struck and the impact sites themselves, determination of whether we're truly looking at projectile-type impacts from firearms, and I mentioned some chemistry, but certainly there's a visual factor that ties into that as well, an assessment of the trajectories themselves relative to the vehicles. In other words, are we talking about a perforation of a windshield coming from the driver's side or the passenger side, and then trying to establish as best as possible where the vehicle was when it was struck, and then, of course, we can back extrapolate the trajectory to potential areas where the shot came from. I think that's probably what's on everybody's mind first.
Michael Haig is the co-author of the book Shooting Incident Reconstruction with his father, Lucian Haig. And we thank you for your time and your insights.
You bet.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Life expectancy in the U.S. is getting longer. As of 2012, the average span had extended to 78.8 years. That has created other challenges and options, including more palliative care and a need for additional caregivers. Those are just a couple of the topics that will be covered at this weekend's final transition conference in Tucson. One of the presenters is Sheila Warnock, who specializes in caregiving. She says more people, especially baby boomers, are more willing to talk about end of life than previous generations.
When you don't know what something is about or you don't understand it or it's foggy or you have fears about it, if you can't express them or talk about them and learn from others who have have the experience in that area, or like some of the experts who are coming. I mean, that's their life's work. It's the best way to grow and get past your fears is to start talking about them and learning about them. And I do think that boomers are the type of people that are not going to age like their parents aged. You know, everybody's trying to stay as healthy and fit as they possibly can, and I think they're working longer, too. It's a different kind of aging, but in the end, we all have to, you know, pass away at some point.
It seems like the expanding use or expanding reach of hospice, how has that changed things? What are your thoughts on hospice?
It's very important. A lot of people don't really make use of hospice until the very end, when those services could be helping them much sooner than they allow them to. I think hospice people are wonderful because they help you if you are, you know, a non-medical person to understand when death is really close, you know, when it's coming sooner, because I don't think people recognize that in their loved ones so much because maybe it's too close or it hurts too much, but they really walk you through every step of the way. They're with you. You get the best care for your loved one when they're at that stage. It's phenomenal, the difference that hospice makes.
Can hospice make it so people are perhaps less scared about what's next?
You know, I think people being scared or not scared of death is an individual thing, and it's not something that, you know, somebody can just change your mind about. Again, it's having dialogues about this, reading articles about death and dying, helping others, and this is why Share the Care is important, helping others who are going through, you know, end of life. You learn so much from doing that. It helps to prepare you for anything that comes down the road for you in the future. And also, when you're working together as a group of people, it's much less frightening to face death, you know, because you can talk about it and discuss it and have the support of others when you're feeling vulnerable.
However long you live, no one's going to live forever. Is there a certain commonality that we all have because of that? And does that make it ultimately easier to talk about, more productive to talk about?
At the end of life, there's so much opportunity for healing, not curing, healing. So much emotional baggage that people might have with someone that can be cleared up with a few words, with a touch, with just being with someone when they're at that point.
Sheila Warnock, one of the presenters at this weekend's Final Transition Conference in Tucson.
Coming up on the show, Cardinals fans may be in for a surprise this season.
Those of us that have been here longer than 2 nanoseconds know that the Cardinals were anything but consistent.
There's hope in store when the season kicks off on Sunday. That and more just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. With Steve, I'm Mark. Quick check of Valley traffic, 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at Alma School. And on the 17 southbound, the exit ramp to the 101 is restricted. Mostly sunny skies in the valley forecast for today. Look for a high of 102. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the lower 80s. Partly to mostly sunny skies over the weekend with highs of 104 and 101 on those days. It's 98 degrees at KJZZ at 219.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Griebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
The Arizona Cardinals kick off their 2015 NFL season on Sunday against the New Orleans Saints. Incredibly, considering the organization's lack of success historically, the Cardinals are expected to make the playoffs for a second consecutive season. Brett Sesmat is the CEO of Sports 360 AZ and a longtime Valley sportscaster. Brett, put this in some historical context. Yes, the Cardinals have had a couple of good years here and there, but this actually looks like they may have sustained success. Are you surprised? And what's made the difference?
I am surprised that they are the team that has shown the most consistency from an ownership standpoint. Those of us that have been here longer than 2 nanoseconds in Arizona know that the Cardinals were anything but consistent. They were right there with the Raiders in terms of commitment to incompetence for years and years. And there was not much traction at all in terms of fan interest. Part of that was playing at Sun Devil Stadium. Then the way the vote went down to get the stadium built out in Glendale, there was that kind of hairy eyeball raised by the fans, like, are they really going to follow through? And then there were the Dennis Green teams that fell apart. They went to the Super Bowl. They fell apart then. But I think Michael Bidwell, Michael's done a tremendous job in leading the Cardinals organization.
The way the money's coming in, you know, teams don't really, they don't really need to commit. I mean, there are plenty of teams around the league who don't really commit to spending the kind of money and trying to get the talent here. So other than Michael Bidwell having some kind of revelation, couldn't the Cardinals have coasted? They had their new stadium. Couldn't they have decided, we don't really want to invest all this time and money and having a huge coaching staff. We could have just coasted, right or not?
You could have gone that route, Steve, but the narrative of the Cardinals being cheap, okay, and I think that's what you're alluding to here. This was a very frugal organization. I remember I had a veteran player, and I won't say who it was. He pulled me out. He was charged in his paycheck for socks, $2, right? So that shouldn't happen. I was told by other players that there were people within the Cardinal organization, this was back in the 90s, that they would take out every other light bulb within the locker room to save on costs. Nowadays, if you have that type of perception, you're not going to have somebody like Carson Palmer saying, I want to come to Arizona. You wouldn't have Patrick Peterson signing an extension to stay here. So I think that whole narrative of the 90s of this being a cheap, dysfunctional franchise, I would say you've got to put that in the rearview mirror.
If somehow they were able to win the Super Bowl this year, where do you rank that in terms of the importance to this community? And frankly, how shocking would it be, even though we've talked about it's a much better organization now, if someone had told you in 1990 the Cardinals would win a Super Bowl before the Suns won a championship, what would you have thought?
It would be huge, obviously, for the Cardinals to do that. But honestly, Steve, I could see them completely falling on their faces. If their offensive line isn't good on Sunday against the Saints, and next week they play the Bears aren't any good. They should be 2-0. But if their offensive line isn't very good, and if Carson Palmer gets hurt, I could see this being a 6-10 season. And if the Cardinals aren't a playoff team, this would go down as one of the biggest letdowns of any football season that I've ever seen in Arizona.
Brad Sesmat is CEO of Sports 360 AZ, a longtime sportscaster, longtime sports radio host in the Valley. Brad, thanks as always.
Steve, great to talk to you.
Scientists have discovered a new human-like species in a cave in South Africa. The discovery of 15 partial skeletons is the largest ever discovery of primitive human remains in Africa. The individuals are part human and part ape. Researchers say the species could be a bridge between the two. The BBC's Palib Ghosh has been to the caves where the remains were found and the vaults where the bones are stored near the South African capital, Johannesburg, and has this report.
A deserted South African landscape. Here, scientists have set up a command center to begin an extraordinary journey that will change our ideas about how the first humans evolved.
All right. Good luck.
Professor Lee Berger waves goodbye to a group of 6 women scientists who work for him. They enter the mouth of the cave and begin a precarious 20-minute journey through an underground tunnel. It's a tight fit, so narrow they can barely squeeze through. One of them slips and falls, but is saved by her climbing rope. Then they enter a chamber, lit only by the torches on their helmets. They see hundreds of bones. There are fragments of skulls, hands, feet and teeth. Professor Berger watches by video relay from the surface.
That's it.
The women found 15 partial skeletons in what is the biggest find of ancient human-like remains ever found in Africa.
Hello, Marina.
Marina Elliott was among them.
was a mixture of excitement and fear and curiosity. And yeah, it was a wild ride.
I mean, some of you were in tears when you came out.
Yes. Yeah, I think it was really emotional for a lot of people. The very first time I went through, I likened it to the feeling that Howard Carter must have had when he opened Tutankhamun's tomb. All of a sudden, all you can see are these wonderful things. It was really incredible. Just watch your step here. It is a bit loose. So off to our left here.
Marina took me to the cave. We discussed how in Victorian times the view was that there was a smooth transition from monkey to great ape to human, and that evolution happened somewhere in Europe. But discoveries of primitive humans in Africa in the 20th century, notably Lucy found in Ethiopia in 1974, suggested that the cradle of humankind was here. I'm just walking through the narrow part of this cave, and it's here that the Naledi people would bring their dead deep into this system. Now, if that is the case, it would be the first evidence of ritual behaviour in a species, possibly millions of years earlier than anyone had ever thought. I went back with Marina to Wits University in Johannesburg, where the bones are now kept under the watchful eye of Professor Berger.
You're about to enter one of the largest paleontological vaults in the world. Here you see...
That's the Naledi.
Specimen of Naledi, in fact. There's a reconstruction of the skull, but more importantly, in that box are the real thing.
The skull looks like a child's skull.
It does. It looks like a child's skull, but only in size. That, in fact, is a full adult.
And its teeth look quite human-like.
It's superficially they do it. In fact, the teeth are shaped more like a primitive ancestor. The anterior teeth, though, the front teeth, totally unique. While it's primitive in many, many other parts of the body, in the foot, and in fact the whole lower leg with its long legs, it's very, very advanced.
There's a little hand there as well.
Those are the most curved fingers we've ever seen in a primitive human ancestor, outside of a 4 or 5 million-year-old hominid like Ardipithecus ramidus.
So does this mean we're going to have to rethink our theories of human evolution? Because once upon a time we thought it was a straightforward linear evolution from monkey to ape to human, and now we're finding all kinds of creatures that lived long ago.
The Victorian idea of a ladder-like human evolution is proven wrong. It's been proven wrong by other finds, but Naledi puts the stamp on the idea that diversity must have occurred in our past. There were many, many experiments. How they relate to us are the next big questions.
That's the BBC science reporter, Palab Ghosh.
It turns out that evolution included the desire for stimulants. When it comes to getting that jolt of caffeine to get the day started or knock out the afternoon blahs, modern men and women aren't that different from our ancestors. Though they didn't have drive-through windows, people nearly 2,000 years ago used caffeine via holly and cacao. That discovery was just made by a team led by University of New Mexico anthropology professor Patricia Crown.
My collaborators and I were looking at archaeological ceramic fragments from 18 sites in the American Southwest and northern Mexico. So 177 samples were run looking for organic residues left in the fabric of the ceramics that would represent what are called the methyl xanthines, which include caffeine. So residues that in North America indicate that there were drinks made out of really only a couple of possible plants, and those are cacao or chocolate drinks and ilex or holly drinks.
Were you surprised that these things, not that they were used perhaps in drinks, but that they were so readily available and perhaps more common than we thought?
No other researchers had found holly residues in ceramics to date for the Southwest or northern Mexico. So we were surprised that so many of our samples seemed to, the patterns of the residues seemed to suggest that holly plants were being brought here. It can't just be any holly plant. The holly that has high caffeine that we're seeing is a holly, unfortunately, called Ilex vomitoria, which mostly grows along the in the southeastern U.S. and along the Gulf Coast. So the closest place to the Southwest would be probably the Texas coast, which is quite a ways.
Potentially, what would some of these conversations have sounded like as far as word of mouth? Would someone have said, oh, you know, this obviously I'm translating to English here, but wow, this is quite a—
it wouldn't have sounded anything exactly like what you're saying.
Nothing like this at all. But wow, here's a stimulating drink we can make from this holly or this cacao. You should try it. Would it have been the same sort of conversation in a sense that we would have today if someone were saying, wow, I just tried this mocha chai or something?
I think part of what's surprising, people very early in the Southwest, including Arizona, were fully aware of resources at a great distance, and they had the networks in order to get those resources. Plants that could be made into consumable drinks.
What sort of connections do you think it can help us make? I'm making the leap to say, well, I guess it shows that human beings, even as we've advanced, haven't changed quite as much as maybe some people would have presumed, that these were interests, these were stimulations, whatever, that would have been around many, many hundreds of years ago.
I agree with you completely. I think that it makes connections between who we are today and how people were 1,000 years ago, well, almost 2,000 years ago, and really suggests to us that things are not all that different than they were, that people liked stimulating drinks of this kind and were willing to go far and make connections in order to get them, and that consuming drinks, even non-alcoholic drinks of these kinds, is a part of the human experience. And almost anywhere we see caffeinated plants, we see people developing them into foods and drinks and consuming them.
University of New Mexico anthropology professor Patricia Crown. Tomorrow morning, a different perspective on the Southwest water challenges will be on display through the annual Water is Life Run on the Hopi Reservation. The event is intended to teach participants how important water and running are in what Hopis believe. Kim Sekakuku is the run's coordinator.
Some of the villages are facing water issues related to high levels of arsenic that has contaminated the water. And so I know that the tribe, as well as Indian Health Services and some of the villages, have been working together to create an alternative solution. But that alternative solution is going to take many years to complete.
Is there a feeling that the land, the trails, have not been treated with proper respect? And could the run be a way to remind people of that as well?
The run, yes, also provides for a cultural preservation of the trails that are ancient and have been in use as part of our spiritual and cultural aspect of Hopi lifeways. During ceremonial time and even just a means of communication, members would walk from the village down to the field and use those trails. They would also use them during ceremonies to go and offer prayers. This is our cultural way of life, and this run actually provides an opportunity to preserve and sustain those trails through maintenance of them, keeping them open.
Kim, is there a special bond that members of the Hopi tribe through the generations have had with the actual running, being close to nature, and getting out there and having that physical activity?
It's a great health benefit. It's a great spiritual benefit. And it's all part of our Hopi society and culture, in terms of how running is a part of our life. Our Hopi High School cross-country team has won 25 consecutive state championships, all as a result of ingraining and instilling their cultural values of running into their techniques.
Kim Sekakuku, the coordinator of tomorrow morning's Water is Life Run on the Hopi Reservation.
Coming up, how a legendary comedian got started collecting Chicano art.
In the beginning, I was just collecting art because, you know, something to hang over the couch and something good. And then all the Chicano artists got onto that. Oh, there's a live one over here, you know.
Cheech Marin talks about art, culture, and comedy. It's the show.
And good afternoon. Quick check of Valley traffic. Be on the lookout for accidents. I-17 southbound at the 101. There's also a collision on the 202 westbound at Alma School. Valley weather for the rest of the day. We should stay partly sunny, maybe partly cloudy as well, with overnight lows expected to reach 80 degrees. Currently, relative humidity is at 26%, and it's 97 degrees at 2:34.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Department of Health Services. 1 in 2 Arizona teens will try alcohol before graduating high school. Learn more about how to talk with your kids about the dangers of underage drinking at azhealth.gov/itmatters.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The House has voted against the nuclear agreement with Iran. 25 Democrats joined Republicans in registering their disapproval of the deal. House Speaker John Boehner called the agreement far worse than he could have imagined.
Never in our history has something with so many consequences for our national security been rammed through with such little support.
But Democratic Congressman Jared Huffman of California spoke in favor of the agreement.
Experts agree that this deal can and will keep Iran's nuclear program in a box for at least the next 15 years.
Also today, the House passed a measure that would restrict the president's authority to lift sanctions against Iran, a key part of the deal, but both votes were largely symbolic. The president has enough support in the Senate to keep any legislation that would undermine the Iran deal from being enacted. A major new federal study finds that treating high blood pressure more aggressively than usual can reduce the risk of heart disease and death in those over the age of 50. People are typically diagnosed as having high blood pressure once their readings hit or exceed a measurement of 140 over 90. The lead researcher in the study, Dr. Jackson Wright, says getting that top number down to 120
can reduce cardiovascular complications, including heart attacks, heart failure, and stroke, as well as the risk of death.
The National Institutes of Health reported the preliminary results today. The findings were so striking that the study was ended about a year early. On this 14th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, several hundred people gathered at Ground Zero in New York City today. They attended a ceremony in memory of those killed. After a period of silence, the bagpipes played. Nearly 3,000 people were killed in the 9/11 attacks. This is NPR News from Washington.
Is there a better way to wash organic leafy greens before putting them in our salads or on our plates? A researcher at the U of A says yes. Sadhana Ravi Shankar, an associate professor in the School of Animal and Comparative Biomedical Sciences, has been studying this and has come up with something natural.
One of the main focus in our lab is fresh produce safety. And we had a grant from the USDA on improving the safety and quality of organic leafy greens. So we have been looking at farm-to-fork produce safety. So basically looking at what are the field conditions that can cause contamination on the leafy greens all the way up to post-harvest, how we can sanitize these leafy greens so that they are safer for the consumers.
So what kinds of bacteria do you find on leafy greens once they've been picked and presumably are heading either to a grocery store or to somebody's table?
The main foodborne pathogenic bacteria of concern in organic leafy greens include Salmonella and Escherichia coli 015787.
That's E. coli.
That's E. coli, exactly. Yeah, commonly called E. coli. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard about Salmonella and E. coli very well because we have had a number of outbreaks with these pathogenic bacteria on leafy greens.
So how do you try to get rid of them?
So we basically try to use antimicrobials, and we are looking at natural antimicrobials, specifically from plants. So we call them phytoantimicrobials because we find that these are natural, and the current consumers, they are aware of many of the health risks that can arise out of the consumption of chemical preservatives, and they do prefer natural ingredients in their food products. So we are mainly looking at natural plant-based antimicrobials such as plant extracts, essential oils, and their active components in the wash water for washing leafy greens so that we can reduce or inactivate the foodborne pathogenic bacteria that might be found on organic leafy greens.
What kind of plants have you been using?
We have been using essential oils such as oregano oil, cinnamon oil, lemongrass oil, clovered oil, and their active components. And looking at the extracts, we have been using extracts made of olive juice. We have apple skin extracts, grape seed extracts, and so on.
How would you envision consumers using these products?
Okay, for the consumers, what they could do is they can get these essential oils in the health stores. And when they wash their leafy greens, what they could do is in a container, they can add water and add a few drops of these essential oils. Plus, they can add a small amount of vinegar, and then they can wash the leafy greens. And then they can store them. And one benefit of these essential oils or plant extracts is they continue to act on the bacteria. That means they have a residual activity. So they will continue to kill the bacteria during storage as well. So we have done studies looking at the bactericidal activities of these plant compounds with storage. And we have seen that as you store these leafy greens, they are going to continue to kill the bacteria, which means they would not only kill whatever is present on the leafy greens, but also let's say there's a cross-contamination down the road. These plant compounds will also be able to take care of those as well.
And it sounds like consumers wouldn't need to use a lot of those oils or extracts to get
the job
done.
No, they will be adding just a few drops. And the best thing would be to store it, because what we have seen is they have a pretty high antimicrobial activity by, let's say, day one or day three of storage.
Sadhana Ravishankar is an associate professor in the School of Animal and Comparative Biomedical Sciences at the University of Arizona. Members of the business community have been talking for a little while now about the potential they see in drones. This week, firms that handle retail facilities maintenance have been hearing about how unmanned aerial systems could help them do their jobs more safely and less expensively. Josh Pola is chief operating officer for the South Bend, Indiana-based firm Springwise Facility Management, and gave a presentation on drones at the Professional Retail Store Maintenance Association conference, which was held in Scottsdale.
One of the things that drones really offer us is the ability to get kind of a broad picture and video use of a lot of the sites and facilities where either you wouldn't be able to get them safely or feasibly without planes, helicopters, or other challenges. So it really is another tool in our tool belt as far as facilities go.
What kinds of information are you talking about here?
It could be anything from rooftop surveys to retention pond surveys to snow conditions on top of a building. I know you guys probably don't have that issue.
Not such
Phoenix.
A big deal here, but...
But, you know, Boston, you know, had, what, 7 or 8 named storms this past winter, and the applications there, you know, were just paramount. The challenge that we face is that because it's such an emerging industry still, the FAA is still developing a lot of the regulations around how you can commercially use drones.
We hear so much about organizations like Amazon maybe using drones to deliver packages or things like that. Are you anticipating that the rules that will apply to what you're trying to do with drones will be similar or the same to what other commercial entities are dealing with?
You know, it's hard to really say what kind of regulations the FAA is going to impose, but because the technology is changing so fast and becoming so more readily available, you know, the thing about it is that they're going to have to do something very quickly. And my anticipation is that they will treat all commercial use the same.
The kind of information that you're talking about being able to potentially get from drones, how are you getting it now?
In some cases, we are putting an employee on a rooftop, or we are putting an employee, you know, with a camera in certain places. The big thing from our industry, drones are going to be impacting us much like digital cameras did when they first came around. You know, before digital cameras, if you wanted to have a clear picture of what something looked like on a rooftop or at a facility, you had to take a picture, develop it, and mail it off to corporate or somewhere else. You know, with the advent of digital cameras, that all changed. Drones are going to be very similar. You know, they're going to allow us to get information, especially video, much more easily and readily available and quickly, so that we can make more informed decisions, you know, about our buildings and our spaces.
So with the increased use of drones, does that mean fewer humans are needed in your line of work?
I wouldn't say that. In fact, drone usage is a very technical piece of what we do, and actually we are going to be adding staff to help manage this. So I don't think it will, you know, have any job reduction potential. I think what it will do is allow us to look at things, you know, much more holistically.
Do you envision this as being useful for both bigger type employers, like a big box type store, and smaller ones, or are there some of those types of retailers that this might be more useful for?
You know, I think it has applications for both. However, I think that the larger the space, the more likely and the more quantity of potential applications there would be.
Have you been able to get permission from the FAA to start doing some of this in some places?
We are currently in the process and awaiting final approval. We've submitted all of our FAA regulation paperwork. Expect to have that back and ready to go for commercial use within the next 30 days.
Josh Pola is COO of Springwise Facility Management based in South Bend, Indiana. He's been presenting this week on the use of drones in facility maintenance at the Professional Retail Store Maintenance Association, which is holding its conference in Scottsdale. Josh, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
And in an email, a spokesman for the FAA says the agency has published a proposed rule for small unmanned aircraft and expects it to become final next summer. He also says people should neither fly drones anywhere near manned aircraft nor near unprotected people on the ground. Mesa has recently launched two websites aimed at helping businesses in the city. One helps companies with market analysis, the other helps them find space. Kim Lofgren is the Marketing and Business Development Manager for the Mesa Office of Economic Development.
One of the interesting things about an economic development group is that we're trying to, and you might say this is our mission, is to help grow the economy, help improve the quality of life for city residents. And the way we do that is we help businesses grow, we help them create jobs and capital investment in the community. And so in order to do that, we have to look at ways, well, how do we help these companies grow? And Mesa has 15,000 plus businesses. Much of these businesses are small businesses. And, you know, so how do we, as a department with limited people, limited resources, help these businesses grow and succeed? Well, one of the ways that we can do that is help them with one of the most important parts of success in business, and that is to understand their marketplace, understand their competitors, and understand their customers.
So is this something that other cities have done as well? If you bought it, presumably the company that made it for someone else as well.
They did. And you can find this tool in cities across the country. And it's a great tool and provides tremendous amount of information for these companies.
The other site that the city has come up with is called Mesa Site Search, and it sounds like this is basically a way for companies who are looking for space to find it.
Exactly. One of the things that you'll find is when companies are trying to make a decision about where they're going to locate, it used to be they would call various cities that seem to be strategic fits, and they would call them and say, hey, give us information. We want to know about your business environment. We want to know about CENI programs. We want to know about your labor force. We want to know about properties. Well, that was yesterday. Today, you can get a lot of this information 24/7 online. And when companies are doing that, we don't hear from them until we're on the short list. And it's critical for us to be communicating with these companies long before we get to the short list. And in order to do that, we need to provide them information. Land sites, land opportunities, buildings, this kind of information is critical for them to put us on the short list.
So it's pretty obvious what businesses get out of this. It's a lot of free information, stuff that a lot of businesses end up having to pay for themselves or do themselves and spend resources on. What does the city get out of this?
Well, like I said, our mission is to help companies grow and succeed so that they create quality jobs, they invest in the community, and just improves the quality of life for the entire community. It provides jobs for members of the community, and it helps us do our job. These tools help us do our job without us having to hire many additional employees and spend a huge amounts of time and effort in going out and meeting with these companies in other ways. So it's a great an efficient way for us to help businesses succeed.
You're basically letting businesses come to you, or in this case, come to the website, instead
exactly.
of you having to go out. So is there some kind of tracking tool where if a business does a search on one of these sites, you'll get a notification of who's looking?
You know, we have analytics that we can go in and we can see how often the pages hit. We can see the growth in numbers and of unique views. We can see how long companies are on the site. So we can track the success of the site.
Is this going to become a marketing tool for the city that you can tell businesses, hey, if you come here, we are going to offer you all these free services that, you know, if you go somewhere else, you might have to pay for yourself?
Well, it could be. It could be. You know, very, very large corporations, you know, an Apple doesn't need a tool like this. But a small company, you know, they have 10, 20, even maybe 50, 100 employees, you know, could really use a tool like this. And it could be a good marketing tool. And we're focused right now on marketing it to existing businesses. But we can certainly use this to market to companies that are considering Mesa.
Kim Lofgren is the Marketing and Business Development Manager for the Mesa Office of Economic Development. By the way, he says the two sites combined, Mesa Site Search and Mesa Size Up, cost the city about $17,000 for the year.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody at 2:50.
KJZZ is supported by the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, hosting Wellness in the Workplace, Developing a Winning Mindset. Help your business create a healthier work environment. September 29th, Sheraton Phoenix Downtown, phoenixchamber.com.
Cheech Marin has been a celebrity for more than 40 years. His fame started when he was part of the pot-smoking counterculture comedy duo Cheech and Chong. Since then, he's done some acting in TV and film, but in his private life, he's become a well-known collector of Chicano art. And that's what's brought him to the Valley as part of the kickoff of 5 new exhibitions in the Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum, including 42 of his own collection. So, Cheech, how would you define Chicano art?
Chicano art is essentially art by Chicanos. And what is a Chicano? Mm-hmm. Chicano is a, strictly speaking, a Mexican-American with a defiant political attitude.
Okay.
It's a voluntary category. You have to declare yourself a Chicano in order to be one. You can't check a box on the census bureau thing. But there's no Chicano. But you can get a PhD in Chicano studies from Harvard University. Yeah. So what is the message? We exist, we don't exist. And originally it was a derisive term by Mexicans to other Mexicans mm-hmm. living in this country, the concept being that the Mexicans were living now in the United States were no longer truly Mexicanos because they had left their country. They were living in tin shacks along the border on the California, Arizona, or Texas side. So they were something less. They were smaller. They were chicos. They were Chicanos, little satellite Mexicans.
So does the political nature you're talking about and what a Chicano is, does that... How often do we see that in the art?
Well, when it started, it was all about that okay. because the Chicano art movement was the visual face of the Chicano civil rights movement, and it was all about protest and demanding rights and equality and those kind of things. So it was all very defiant and in your face, and not a lot of museums wanted to show that, you know, because they want to be picketed by these damn Chicanos, you know, headband wearing, double smoking, fist waving Chicanos. It evolved very quickly into something more. Not just it wasn't solely a political platform. Each individual artist started to develop their own artistic vision, mm-hmm. and it went into a lot of different areas, whether it's historical or gender-based or humor-based or sociological or even abstract.
So you've been collecting for more than 3 decades. Do you have a whole variety?
I have a whole variety, yeah. right from the beginning to right what's happening yesterday. You
okay.
know? Because I watch these artists evolve and develop, and you know some of them I watch for a long time before I buy. Because I want to see them develop into what they're going to be, you know, Chicano bent. And being a Chicano, I mean, a lot of the young potential Chicanos are not Chicanos because they don't even really know what it is, you know.
When you first started collecting, mm-hmm. I mean, you're doing this as a private citizen.
Uh-huh.
But were there certain expectations placed on the fact that, oh, my God, here's Cheech Marin who's collecting this, and we know him as a comedian, we know him as an actor, we know him as a performer. Does he really know what he's doing when he's collecting this? I mean, do people sort of look at you as saying, oh, you're just a celebrity buying art?
You know, at the beginning, I started I discovered these Chicano painters and like, wow, these guys are really good, because I knew what good painting was, having studied it my whole life. I was classically trained, autodidactically. I went to the library and took out all the art books when I started when I was around 11. And I would, okay, that's Rembrandt. Okay, that's Picasso. That, you know, so I knew, and the gap in my knowledge was contemporary art. So I started going to galleries on the west side of LA. That's where I discovered these Chicanos, and immediately I know these guys are good painters. I mean, because I knew what good painting was, and I had seen it all my life, and these guys are good. So I started just buying art, because it was the perfect storm. I had the money, I had the and I knew what it was, and I had the celebrity in order to expound upon it. But that's not what I did at the beginning. I was just collecting art, because you know, something to hang over the couch and something good, and then all the Chicano artists got onto that. Oh, there's a live one over here, you know.
So I just read Steve Martin's autobiography.
Uh-huh.
And he sort of went back to when he first started doing stand-up. Part of what I think made you and your partner so great was that people could listen to it on records and they could sort of get into that. Is that a lost art?
Oh, yeah, absolutely it is right now. There's nobody doing that. We were the only ones doing it even in the day.
Yeah.
Our other contemporaries, George Carlin, Lily Tomlin, Steve Martin, all those guys, their records were recordings of their live act. And they were live in a club or a theater or wherever. And we went into the studio and made up these scenes. You know, they didn't have a laugh track, didn't have an audience. That's why they could play so well over and over and over repeatedly, because you hear something else, you hear something new, you come to a different understanding. Your physical or mental state is different every time you see it. And so they've endured, you know, but they were radio theater, basically.
There's nothing less funny than trying to figure out what makes something funny.
Right.
But what about, you know, comedy's an art in and of itself, yeah. Right? So you were an artist in that sense, too.
I was always a comedy fan from a little kid. I came from a very funny family, and everybody in my family was funny and very smart and very quick. And so you had to really compete to get time at the dinner table to do your stuff. It's something that I was always aware of as a kid. I read everything that was in Boy's Life or Reader's Digest, Little Jokes. I watched everybody that was on Ed Sullivan's show, and I just love comics. And, you know, and even the worst ones, are not that there is a worst one, but even the ones that, you know, okay, there was one thing in their act that just cracked you up, you know, or else I wouldn't be a professional comedian.
Yeah.
So I always listened for that.
Legendary comedian and longtime collector of Chicano art, Cheech Marin. He's in the Valley as part of a kickoff of 5 new exhibitions in the Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum. Cheech, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Every place has its unique set of street names, and we're no exception. But you might be surprised to know where one familiar street name actually comes from. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez takes us on the road.
Broadway, McDowell, McClintock, these are just a few street and road names that Valley City officials thought were important ones to honor. Well, some roadways have unique backstories. Did you know Hayden Road is not named after Tempe founding member Charles Hayden?
Here at Hayden and McDowell was the Hayden family, Wilfred Hayden.
Joanne Handley is with the Scottsdale Historical Museum. She's also a lifelong Scottsdale resident, with family roots going back several generations.
He did general farming. He had alfalfa and grains and things, and mostly what he did was he sold his to the dairy farmers who had dairy cows.
The Wilfred Hayden farm was among just a few in the area in the late 1890s. The family helped create a working community where everyone pitched in with each other's farm to pick crops. During the Depression, many of the farmers lost their property. The Haydens didn't, and lived in the area until the 1960s. Hayden Road starts right around the Loop 101 in North Scottsdale and ends intentionally on the south end in Tempe.
And this was Tempe. Tempe says, we are not changing our name to Scottsdale's names. And Scottsdale says, we're not changing our name to Tempe's names. So we stop at this side of the canal.
So south of the canal is where I headed and met up with Tempe preservationist John Southard, and had to ask, Does the Tempe Hayden family have a street name honoring them in their own city?
We're here on McClintock, just south of University, very close to and approaching Don Carlos, which is a street that, although many might not immediately associate it with him, is named for Tempe founder Charles Hayden.
Souther says Don Carlos is what Spanish-speaking residents called him. The street is located between University Drive and Apache Boulevard.
Hayden, in 1890, moved from what we know today as Monte's La Casa Vieja at the corner of Mill and Rio Salado in the heart of the bustling 1890 Tempe out to the country, what is now University in McClintock.
Like the Scottsdale Hayden Farm, the Tempe Hayden Ranch is gone today. Businesses, apartment buildings, stores, and restaurants have replaced them. Historians say road names are often created by communities. Others were landmarks that were eventually adopted as official street names. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know things that you think we ought to know, please send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Well, it's the weekend, and unless you're like me and Mark, you should probably leave your home to go do something. Arizona Diamondbacks hosting the LA Dodgers all weekend, 3-game series.
You can also check out the Phoenix Mercury hosting the LA Sparks tonight at U.S. Airways Center.
And Of Mice and Men is playing tonight at 7:30 at the Desert Stages Theater in Scottsdale. Mark, I like to consider us both mice and men.
Oh, I'm not sure what that means, but sure, I'll go with that.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor, Tracy Greer, news director, Al Macias, our executive producer, John the Unbridled One, Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Send us an email, theshow@kjzz.org. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.